Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 7 of the Parent Teacher Podcast. This is Casey, your host. This platform is meant to serve as a space to have some conversations, maybe create some awareness, get some information on topics relevant to education. And I would like to put it out there so that anybody who has an interest in helping any of our learners become successful adults can know what questions to ask. I guess that's kind of what it comes down to. It's July, it's the end of July, and it has been a pretty unstructured summer. At my house, we haven't had 2 weeks with the same schedule since school got out, so it's been just a little bit hectic. Several times in this podcast and in others, I refer to the blog. I will beef that up when I have kids with routines and full-time school, I think. But for now, you can find links to the most relevant articles that we refer to and possibly some resources in the show notes. You can also find information and the blog, which will need updating, at my website, which is reorientedadvocacy.com. You'll hear us talk a little bit about the importance of advocacy. And if you aren't familiar with what that is, what that looks like as I do it, you can definitely check out my website there. The school year is coming and I'm happy to answer any of your questions. Please shoot me an email. You can record a voice message, and I'm also happy to hook any of you up with the Facebook groups that Erin mentions. I think that would be an invaluable resource, whether you're a parent or a teacher who needs some support. So you can connect with me and I will get you set up there. Let's get started. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges with special education teachers in both hiring and retention. So the statistic that I found at Education Week says that the number of special education teachers in the country has dropped by 17%. And another statistic is that there's one certified special ed teacher for every 17 students with a disability. The number of special education students did drop about 1%, but we keep seeing articles on the teacher crisis nationwide, and we know that these are hard to staff jobs. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges in teaching special education and hopefully some ways that we can change that and support teachers. So I have brought on a guest today. I'm talking with Erin Young. She's a CPS teacher. She's been in a special ed classroom for 14 years, going into 15 years. Erin, I came to my attention and I had met her previously because she is involved with the CTU. And I would call Erin a teacher advocate. That's fair?
Yeah, I would say that's fair.
Yeah. So really briefly, Erin is active in the Chicago Teachers Union Special Ed Committee. She's on the CPS Special Ed Task Force. She is definitely well informed on a lot of policies and initiatives. And she has also done some PD, a lot of focus on social emotional learning. So I'm hoping that we'll also have some resources on the blog that Erin can help me curate to share with teachers so that we can support them. Thank you very much for coming and talking to me today. So I'm going to ask you to just kind of start with your own experience in entering teaching. So what brought you into special ed, first of all? And what were you thinking it was like? And how was the beginning for you personally?
Well, I have a learning disability. So I came up as a student with a learning disability. I probably would have qualified. I don't know that I actually would have qualified if I hadn't come up, gone through school in the 80s and the 90s, because I also have a relatively high IQ. So I think I might have been one of those kids stuck in the MTSS trap of not getting those supports because my IQ was too high. But I don't know that I would have reached the potential that I reached if I hadn't gotten the supports that I had. So I had a very personal interest in it. I actually graduated from Oak Park River Forest High School, got great supports through River Forest elementary schools, and then went on and started doing volunteer work and had a very particularly difficult group I was working with. And when my time as a volunteer ended, the teacher sent me this great big basket of things thanking me because she said it was so much harder that I wasn't there anymore. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I could do this. I could, you know, I could be a teacher. And it, so it sort of started me on that. And I started working more with kids and developed a passion for it and for wanting to support the community. And then went on and went to Bradley University and then started, actually got my first job interview in Chicago at Luther Burbank, which is in Galewood on the Northwest side. Started there in the 2004-05 school year and I've been there ever since.
Wow. But you know, that's something that we hadn't really talked about is what brings people into the profession. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's a really common vein is that a lot of people recognize something in themselves that they found challenging in school or they formally had their own diagnosis. And a lot of times a close family member.
Yeah.
Right. Or a lot of kids will talk about the Best Buddies program in high school or volunteer work that they did that brought them in.
Right.
So I think it's interesting to me to know the characteristics that draw people into the profession in the first place, that personal connection or, you know, I think high level of empathy. Right.
Right.
And a wish to impact like in a positive way.
Yeah. And I think it just, I'm always surprised, like when people come into like sub in my room as a teacher, they're like afraid of my kids. And so I do think that that personal connection sort of opens a door of, no, this is okay. You don't, you know, they're just kids. Yeah. Be kind to them and they'll be kind to you. And, yeah, you're right. I think that empathy, but just also a lack of fear and just feeling like you could do something positive. And
yeah. And that I think that part of the fear comes from not feeling expert.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I would say that it drives me nuts. Like, oh, you must be an angel. Oh, you must. Yes. I have a lot of patience. Yes. I deal with things that a lot of people don't deal with. But there are also huge rewards with my kids and that connection. And, you know, I know like teachers always feel that spark of joy, but like the first time a child is minimally verbal calls your name, that's like a huge moment. When you take a child that had no communication system whatsoever and you watch them learn to be able to communicate, like I get the teaching, you know, 25 kids in some respects might be harder, but in some respects might be a lot easier than dealing with the behaviors and the emotional stuff and all of the different challenges. But for me, the rewards are just as big. And my kids deserve to have someone who cares enough about them to keep working with them and push through. So, yeah.
So still rewarding work.
It's still
a very fulfilling job. These are some of the positives of being a special ed teacher. Also, I think not having the 25 kids, like you said, for better or worse, you really get to know your learners.
Right. And for me, like I teach my kids for 3 years. So it's a much deeper connection with my parents. That can be a challenge sometimes, but it's also, I have so many parents that keep in contact with me after their child is not with me because they felt safe with me with their child. It's very, troubling when you're a parent of a minimally verbal child and you're sending your baby off to kindergarten for the first time in full-time school. And that's a very nerve-wracking thing. And I'm very aware and sensitive of that. So I have a lot of, you know, I spend a lot of time building that trust with my parents, always being available for when they need me, because that's a huge trust. If your kid can't come home and tell you somebody's hurting them, then you need to feel comfortable with who's taking care of your child. And, you know, you need to feel that they care and want what's best for your child too. And I think that's something I don't know that I was always as prepared for when I started teaching that I needed that. The importance of developing that strong relationship with parents, that trust with parents, is like huge.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think I've said a few times, one of the biggest warning signs that we have a serious problem when I'm working on behalf of parents is when they're like, the teacher doesn't like the kid. It's like, oh yeah, everybody picks up on this pretty quickly when the teacher feels really frustrated. Anyhow, I'm like, we can go on and on about that. I still think that really, until you can address like the teacher's basic needs,
right?
You know, you're going to have burnout. You're going to have frustration.
Yeah, no, and that is, I mean, that is a huge other part of it is it is a very, I think even after doing this for, you know, so many years, over a decade, I've been in this field. I'm not always prepared for sometimes the stressors. I shared with you, I had a parent who ended up taking their life this year. The hit on me emotionally from that was huge. And I don't know that we're always as prepared when, as you know, pre-practice educators coming into the field to know how much of that you're going to take home with you and to know the trauma that you will start carrying because of it. And you, the importance of self-care and making sure, because you cannot be a good teacher if you are completely burnt out.
Yeah. And I know I'm a former CPS teacher and I will definitely say that's true. And something I shared is I think that for me, it happened that I couldn't go home and not think about the kids that I had established this close relationship with, or be frustrated when I wasn't able to get in a place where I felt like a partner with a parent.
Right.
That's exhausting. And just thinking about sustainability even.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm preparing on special ed teachers, I supervise on, you know, I've got to quit calling them kids. I supervise college seniors. And they're about to enter and they're doing a lot of work, a lot, really detailed work. And it's good. And and they need to graduate because we have really high expectations. But I think to myself too, how is this going to be sustainable? Like, how are you going to fit this in your life? Are you, you know, are you going to crash and burn? So that's kind of, it brings me to what I think we're going to focus on today, which is, you know, what are some of the things that maybe aren't so obvious when people talk about the teacher shortage? And we briefly talked about pay. And I was like, why aren't they paying more? If you can't fill a position, doesn't the law of economics say, you know, that it's it needs a better pay rate? People aren't qualified to do the job or aren't willing to, to do the job. And Erin kind of argued with me and she's like, it's not about the pay. I need a smaller class size. And I'm like, but if they paid you more, then somebody could cook your meals. They could clean your house. You could take, you know, I always talk about bandwidth with executive function. And I'm like, you know, they could reduce this load for you. So we're going to let pay go out the window. Although I do feel all teachers do more than.
Yeah, and I'm not arguing that teachers are underpaid. But I think when we start digging into the issues that are really actually driving teachers out of the profession, it's about working conditions within the school and the effect that those working conditions have on you as a person. Because my life, I mean, if I had made $10,000 more a year, I could, you know, go on a nicer vacation, I could do other things. But my day-to-day life, if I had 7 kids instead of 13, would be vastly improved. The amount of attention, the amount of time, the kind of teacher I could be. I think that's another danger that's sort of hidden. Teachers are perfectionists. We want to help kids. We want to do the best. We want to be the best. We have to, you know, we're control freaks. We want to run our little kingdoms and take care of our kids and do what's right. But at some point, the working conditions so exceed your capacity to do that. And then you feel like a failure and you, then that becomes the guilt cycle. And that's more stress and more burnout, because sometimes things are so without side limits of your control that there isn't anything you can do. And learning to compartmentalize, learning to accept the things that you cannot change, I think are some of the biggest things as a teacher that have helped me stay in the profession, because there has been times I've had to look at situations and go, I can't do anything about this. And I need to take a step back because this is beyond what I can do.
It's very stoic. I don't know if you're into this, but I'm like, often I have to branch into my personal philosophy. You know, I found stoicism to be pretty helpful in those situations as well. I guess I'll link that on the blog. But yeah, recognizing when things are under your control, something I teach is especially in like co-teaching situations, is a situation that can be high burnout because, you know, you can't exercise a lot. You don't have a lot of autonomy. You have to partner with somebody who may or may not be a very willing partner. Or on the same page. And so I always say, think of what you can control and then think of what you can influence. Maybe you can't control it, but you can do your part and feel a little bit better about it. And then what you just have to accept, because our energy is limited.
Yeah.
And we want to use it wisely. So Erin came prepared to talk a little bit more about, you know, these kind of, like I said, pay, class size, these are obvious, right? When we talk about the union and what we're asking mm-hmm. for. You'll see the picture of Aaron with the union sign. I also went on strike years and years ago, and it wasn't so much about the pay. It was about the conditions. What are some of these, like, in terms of like soft skills, I think of that mm-hmm. we teach to teachers, or in some of these other ways that we could help them maintain better health, I guess, mm-hmm. and be better prepared to interact with our kids, and I think even model to our kids, right?
Right.
Because I keep thinking of this trickle-down effect where one term we're going to talk about is the trauma. And I'm like, well, who has the trauma? And I'm like, well, everyone has the trauma. The kid is traumatized. So the family has trauma. So the teacher has trauma. When we talk about a teacher feeling overwhelmed, it's like this learned helplessness becomes
right.
part of the cycle. And I'm like, a kid can have learned helplessness. A teacher can have learned helplessness. So I feel like this kind of blurs some of the lines. So let's start with talking about this resource you brought in on managing trauma. Would it,
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about teachers and trauma.
Well, one of the things that is sort of, and I've gotten more interested in it because I've seen the personal effects on myself. You'll start seeing articles about this if you follow any of the teacher blogs, caregiver fatigue or secondary traumatic stress. And so basically, because you are processing and dealing with your students' trauma, it sort of becomes your trauma. You can't let go. You know, I spent a lot of time having intrusive thoughts about my student, what was going to happen to my student whose parent took their life. Mm-hmm. And that took a huge toll on me personally. And it ate up the energy that I could towards problem solving and thinking about curriculums and getting enough rest. It's hard because you just like, oh, and like, you don't want to be, well, what am I feeling bad about? You know, I wasn't my parent. Why is this affecting me so much? But it is part of it. Like when you care for these children, they are part of your life. You are part of their lives. So when you go and you read about it, so I brought from, basically from the National Center for the Safe Supportive Learning Environment. They have it's just like a document. It's just an initial release, but it goes through and it sort of talks about these issues that come up, like increased anxiety and concern, intrusive negative thoughts, fatigue, feeling numb and detached, feeling powerless or hopeless about students and work, diminished concentration, and desire to physically or emotionally withdraw from people. Mm-hmm. And that's basically comes into like, that's burnout, right?
Yeah.
And so I do wonder a lot about teachers who leave the profession, how much of this secondary traumatic stress, particularly those that are working with our students who have lower socioeconomic status, who have experienced incredible trauma themselves. They might have, if you've not read up about ACE scores, it's mm-hmm. It's basically, there's a lot of research on ACE, adverse childhood experiences. And the higher your levels of ACE is, the more likely you are to have negative income on long-term, you know, effects on your life. And they've even done longitudinal studies where they've talked about people, and it causes things like cancer mm-hmm. and heart disease. Stress on the brain damages the brain. And so, you know, if you are someone who is, I've had students who have dealt with evictions, fires, they're sexual abuse survivors, parents are divorced, parents have been killed. All of those things build up. And I thought it was interesting you brought up that even in schools, because I sort of in my Chicago mentality of working with 99% of my kids are low income. Mm-hmm. I think, oh, those kids in the suburbs. But you're right, there is trauma. You do have parents. Maybe a parent is dealing with cancer. Maybe, and their family's getting a divorce. Or there's a job loss and financial insecurity. And these are like universal experiences that as part of the human condition. And I think we need to have recognition as teachers that no matter the setting you're working in, yes, if you're in a more socioeconomic advantaged, you're not going to maybe be dealing with some of like the drive-bys and the, you know, drug use, though not necessarily sometimes. There is drug abuse knows no sort of limit on that. But you still have it and you can still get burnt out and you can still end up feeling. And like one of the things is like anger and cynicism. That was something that I thought was really interesting. They talk about that. Warning signs of vicarious trauma.
So Erin's reading from the list.
Yeah.
And I have the link posted in the show notes as well. But I think that this really is so important that sometimes when you hear the label, it's like name it to tame it. It's like saying Voldemort. Like once you can name something and recognize that it's widely recognized, it's not just you.
Right.
You're feeling angry and cynical and maybe even like angry with a student. Having this knowledge
right.
alone can be so helpful.
Yeah, like hypervigilance. Poor boundaries. That
oh,
should
boy.
Be like a big red flag for every teacher. Poor boundaries. And teachers yeah. are people pleasers. Teachers are fixers. Teachers are control freaks. That is something. And then it is very easy when you are dealing with like even secondary trauma to suddenly allow things to consume your life. And then you're not taking care of yourself.
Well, I think there's a few parts to that. One is, so I'm also really interested in anxiety
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, I hear this a lot from teachers, student teachers dealing with, we touched on perfectionism briefly. It's funny though, how a lot of these characteristics seem to be very, very, they happen a lot. I just blanked out. With special ed teachers. So it's almost like tied to the high empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I call it Hermione Granger syndrome.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to make a lot of Harry Potter references because I work with teenagers in the summer and they get it. But part of when you're feeling anxious and overwhelmed is you avoid. And so you consume yourself in some other project.
Right.
And the other thing about the poor boundaries is another thing I've talked a lot about, and especially in like co-teaching too. Like you said, the people pleasing behavior, or Jennifer Gonzalez on Cult of Pedagogy talked about the dangers of the family mentality in a school.
Right. Yeah.
We're in this together. We're doing it for the kids. You need to go above and beyond or the kids will suffer. And it becomes a culture. It's not even like one person is perpetuating
right.
it like this evil villain. It's this culture of we have to give all of what we are.
Right.
Right. And so that can be a really dangerous mindset. Yeah.
The movie Freedom Riders drives me insane. Like drives me insane.
I don't think I've seen it.
It's like, but she goes, she's a secondary career switch. She gives up her entire life. Damages her marriage. She's working three jobs to basically like take these kids, but she only taught for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then she left to go do this writing project with these kids. And it's great that but it's idealized. It's
right.
like,
it's this not is sustainable.
It's not sustainable. It's
she,
not.
Yeah. She wound up like, who knows what the sequel would look like.
Right.
Probably her.
Not in the classroom.
Right.
And you know, and that's something I worry about too. And, you know, as it takes 10,000 hours to gain mastery of any skill, right? And teaching, especially if you're working at like an elementary level, you could be working with first graders
yes.
all the way to eighth graders. It is years and years and years before you really get a handle on teaching. And most teachers, especially special ed teachers, are leaving before they ever even get to that point.
Well, and again, I think feeling expert helps you manage the rest,
right? Right?
Because again, bandwidth, you can't be learning how to teach this while you're teaching it and feel good about yourself for one
right.
thing. The other thing about elementary is not only might you might be in a classroom where you're teaching third grade and fifth grade, your kids could be learning at a second grade
right.
Reading level. So you really have to master like a ton of curriculum. And then the next year they may move you into a new position.
Right.
And the other part of it is in teacher prep, when we prepare in Illinois anyway, I'm not sure what the laws are like from state to state, to get your learning behavior specialist license, the LBS, at least where I work, we prepare student teachers by having them do clinicals in a behavior setting.
Mm-hmm.
So a setting where you have to manage a lot of behavior, one in more of an adaptive setting. So, you know, significantly modified
mm-hmm.
and one in an academic setting. So it's an effort to give a wide range of experience to everybody and some mentorship in each area, but it's like being a jack of all trades or a Jill of all trades, probably because there aren't a lot of
right.
men in the profession still. There's some, but it doesn't lend you to feel you don't feel like you're well prepared
right.
for what you do for quite some time, which
yeah.
is tough.
Well, and even when you've been in it for a long time, you can still, especially in special ed, you can still get that kid that is so far from left field of anything that you've had experience with. And you just have to learn to sort of roll with it and be aware that, yeah, this is the other thing that was, I think, teaching too. Sometimes you have to look at when you work with a kid and you're not the one that gets them to the fixed point, right? You know, you don't get, so I've had kids where I've had amazing turnarounds, students who came with me who were huge behavior problems, trashing classrooms, all of this sort of craziness. And then in a year or two, I'm able to send them back into the CrossCap setting out of a significantly modified curriculum cluster program setting, because we were able to help them develop those skills that they needed to regulate, and they are able to manage to go back and be successful. But I've had other kids that I haven't been able to do that with.
Yeah.
But part of it is teaching is a journey, and sometimes you are just a stopping point on that journey, and it's your job to get that child to that point so that the next person who gets them, hopefully, is going to be able to get them to there. Sometimes you have to lay a foundation, and you're planting seeds that you are never going to see grow, because it's not going to happen right then. The kid's not developmentally ready. The kid's not emotionally ready. So that's part of it too. And that's not to say, I don't want teachers to think, oh, you just give up and work. It's not, no, you do your best. You're reflective. You work on with that child. If it didn't work, think about it. Think about what didn't work, how you could have done it differently, and be like, okay, next time I'm going to do this, or I'm going to try that.
Well, and not only the academic progress, but I think, like we were saying earlier, the importance of establishing relationships, not only with the parents, but with the kids.
Yeah.
And trauma. The kids who have experienced a lot of trauma can be much harder to connect with. They can come in bringing all kinds of issues that have nothing to do with you as a teacher. And I think I see this especially with beginning teachers, just feeling really frustrated when that kid isn't friendly, when that kid doesn't respond. I mean, it's very difficult.
And here's the thing too, especially when I worked with my kids who are more on the emotional and behavioral spectrum. We would go in, we'd go through honeymoon, they'd wild out on me, we'd get through it, and then it would get worse. And what you're like, what? No, I got worse because they started to trust you.
Right.
And as soon as they started to trust you, well, now you can hurt me. So I'm going to go to all of my sort of patterns that I know and I'm comfortable with, because it's very uncomfortable for me that you are not being abusive to me, because you are not following the pattern that the other adults in my life have followed. Mm-hmm. And I need to try to force you to do that. So I'm going to do whatever I have, and then you can get past it. But that was always sort of like, it was so hard as it was to deal with. It was always like, oh, okay, all right, we're getting somewhere. It's a clue, you know.
But again, it's that awareness of that this is a pattern.
Right.
That this is to be expected. That would be so helpful. If only we could know all of this. If only teachers could have all this training, right? It would really, I think, head off a lot of that internalization of not feeling effective, of,
right,
you know, feeling like, you know, you're failing at something.
Yeah.
So, let's kind of segue into then from the signs of trauma. Mm-hmm. Again, I'll put the list on there. What are some of the solutions, I guess? Like, what are some of the things that would be helpful, can be helpful, I guess, ideal, you know, ideally, how could the system, the school district, the federal government, put supports in place to help us? What are some initiatives maybe that you've heard of? Are there?
Well, I mean, I'm a big believer in collaborative problem solving solutions, which is Dr. Ross Green's work. He wrote The Explosive Child and Lost at School.
I told you guys every single podcast, I think, will mention Ross Green.
He's awesome. And I would encourage any teacher or parent, go to his website, Living in the Balance, take his educator or parent walkthrough, watch those videos, read about that. I think the mind shift of viewing behavioral issues as a lack of a developmental skill is hugely helpful from a teaching perspective.
Yeah.
And from a parenting perspective and from a human perspective.
And so again, briefly, really to summarize, Ross Green is that he really wants to build an awareness that everybody does well when they can.
Right.
It's not they do well when they want to, you know, particularly in students. But again, I think it's interesting that we could blur this over. Parents do well when they can.
Right.
Teachers do well when they can. But what Aaron's talking about is a toolkit. I think it's called the paperwork on the website.
Yeah. And he has videos. There's a that I ran the PD at my school to help us sort of, because it's not being supported in CPS. you know, we have restorative justice on paper, but it's not a supportive initiative in a way a lot of special ed initiatives are not supported initiatives. Yeah. It sounds great, but if we're not supporting it financially, there are huge ripple effects that I think are coming out all over the place throughout the profession.
And that's kind of the problem, I think, is that there are a lot of things that sound good, you know, with the current administration. It's been kind of a one step forward, two steps back.
Right.
We're not really sure where we're at with quite a few of the parts of IDEA, the main law. But a lot of it mandates that teachers do this, and then, you know, how do we get there?
Right. And there's no support for it. Like, just one of, like, this September when I was going through all of this trauma and stress with some of my students, and I was short a paraprofessional. We had a fabulous paraprofessional that we were hiring, and I was so excited to get her because she had been a mentor volunteer in my room, knew my kids. But Chicago went through this whole situation with onboarding, became a process. We couldn't get her in until the beginning of October. So while I was dealing with all of these sort of really complex situations and this parent who, you know, that family situation and all of that trauma, we were not staffed appropriately. And that's what I worry about for teachers, especially new teachers, not filling in those sub positions. My room couldn't really run the way it needed to run. We couldn't, you know, do what we needed to do. And, I wouldn't have been shocked if it had been a first year teacher in that classroom if they had walked out.
Okay.
So it's just, there is no way. I think that we need to sort of universally acknowledge that there is no way that you're going to get through teaching almost in any area that you are not going to deal, maybe not every year, but not deal with some sort of this secondary trauma. Like,
right.
This is something you are going to face. It's not really,
it's not limited to a certain area, class, income.
No,
it happens. It's just that, like I said, in some of those areas, you know, I think of, I taught on the South side, and it was gang issues. So that will ramp up trauma in a neighborhood.
Right.
For sure. So yeah, the staffing has been hard, just attracting paraprofessional issues. This is something I hear frequently. A family will fight for a paraprofessional.
And we can't get it staffed.
And then we can't get it staffed. Or you have somebody awesome one year and it's such a great relationship. And then, you know, the next year they move to a different district and then you can't get it staffed.
Well, in Chicago too, we do a terrible job of training our paraprofessionals. And it's very, going back to our screen, people do well when they can. Mm-hmm. Paras are doing the best that they know how to do. Often teachers are doing the best that they know how to do. But we are not supporting that additional training. We are not, like at my school, we've been fighting for years trying to get safety care training. Safety care is probably equivalent to CPI. It's a de-escalation. It's the approved program for Chicago. So, you know, I teach in a cluster program with students with autism who have sensory and behavioral needs, and I can't get my paras who are working with them to be trained on how to de-escalate. And like, we work on stuff and we work through how, and I support them, but you know, I've only been through the training for level one once. My certificate is lapsed. Often teachers are being left in dangerous situations where you have to make a choice between, do I go to the temporary physical intervention because this child's going to harm themselves or harm someone else? How do I keep that child safe? Am I going to be supported if I take this action? And it's very scary. And
A lot of decisions.
Mm-hmm. And
high-stakes decisions.
In a crisis, too.
Right.
You know, I had an incident where we had, like, our security guard, who I do trust, wasn't there. I had seen one of our other Sekas who used to work. She's the other one I would sort of call, and she worked at the Sonia Sorterman Orthogenic School as a residential counselor. So, and she has some ABA background. So she's fabulous at like managing, and I had a kid in crisis and one of my aides was on lunch. So my other aide had all of my kids sitting on the rug in the front of the room playing Baby Shark on her phone, trying to keep them there. And I'm like, do I evacuate? Do I call 911? Do I really want to bring a police officer in to deal with this child? Do I call the parents?
Answer is no.
No, I don't. And no. I didn't. But those are the things all the while this child is becoming increasingly escalated. I can't evacuate the room with one aide with the other 11 children. It's not safe. what do you do? And you're, you know, so you go through those situations. And so I think that that is leading to a lot of teachers just going, I can't do this.
Right. And then on the flip side, I can think of, you know, seeing parent comments, because again, I participate in a few, you know, Facebook groups related to this that are parent oriented. And they might be saying like, what is going on? I found out today that my kid is watching Baby Shark on the phone in class. And it's like, okay, let's just all assume that everybody is doing the best they can with what they know and the supports they have, and that we need to recognize there is a lot lacking. Not that everybody is perfect, and that, with burnout does come. Some people who just, they've put in that push, that effort, and they are just walking through.
Right.
The, you know, I think of like mile 18 in a marathon. Yeah. Like they have hit a point where they just do not feel supported or effective. And it's tragic. It's sad. So it sounds like we're coming to the conclusion that one thing that would be extremely helpful would be ongoing paid training.
Absolutely.
To support not only the special education teachers, but the paraprofessionals. And from my experience, because I did co-teaching mm-hmm. quite a bit as well, I worked in a resource room, the general education teachers.
Yeah.
I think if, you know, just thinking of the whole process, you had talked about one student you had that then re-entered a less restrictive setting, mm-hmm. Or in identifying students, you know, the training all around could be better. Also working with a lot of families with 2E, and you had brought up your own personal experience with that. I think I am seeing a little increased awareness of teachers who are seeing, oh, this kid is really struggling to pull off the scores that they're getting right now. Mm-hmm. You know, or that when you see that anxiety ramping up, that could be a sign of an underlying problem. And that goes back to Ross Green, like when you see a problem, identify what's the skill deficit.
Right. And how do we address that? Because the problem is just going to keep occurring in different settings if the skill is not there to meet the need. And also with parents too. I work a lot of my parents. Some of them have jumped in wholeheartedly and are educating themselves, but are they getting good advice? Mm-hmm. That's another issue you're going to run into if you work with low socioeconomic status. I have had parents tell parents crazy things, like crazy things, like that a child that's banging their head on the floor and is only repeating Hot Pocket commercials is just trying to get in touch with his manly self. That was literally... Then this was a little boy who had autism and did not get a diagnosis because he came to kindergarten first day and nobody had noticed or kids who are nonverbal at 4 or 5. And because their parents only have access to Medicaid, they only have access to these certain clinics, they're doing the best they can. And so as a teacher, I think you have to stop and think. One of the things that I find super helpful is to have an entire folder in my Google Drive of resources for parents. What are, like, Lutheran General Hospital has a program, they'll take Medicaid there. Lori's, Rush, here are the numbers, go call them, get on the wait list. It's going to be 9 months, I'll tell you.
Like, and it's extremely overwhelming. And even I will get requests occasionally and they'll say, do you know a good therapist for my teen who has, you know, a lot of anxiety? And it changes so frequently. I'm like, well, they've left the practice. This one I'm familiar with, or Rush we brought up earlier. This is a huge issue with mental health with kids. Yeah. Rush is closing their inpatient program, which was, there aren't a lot left in the city. So when you have kids in crisis, and this happens in classrooms as well, it takes some time to figure out support. So, you know, unfortunately, that's just the reality. You might have a small classroom with 8 kids in it, but if one is self-injurious and you're still trying to figure out placement, that teacher's time and
is a huge issue. It's a safety concern. It's a concern for everyone, and trying to get through and helping parents, particularly the population I work with is primarily Latinx. So a lot of my parents don't necessarily speak English. So then you have the added burden of trying to negotiate the system of getting through to these hospitals and these doctors and communicating with them and getting them what they really need. And the cultural understanding of disability and what does this mean and what are the outcomes. And so these are all things that as a teacher, basically you fall into this role of sort of being almost like a social worker, almost like an advocate. Save those resources, have them, find them,
share them.
Anytime I have a parent that has a good experience with a doctor, I will ask them who that doctor is. I will ask them for their number, and I will ask if I can refer parents to them. Special recreations in Chicago is amazing. I've had students who've had amazing experiences with special recreations in their summer program, and it's very affordable. So, but you have to, you know, find the parks that are located by you. You have to make sure that you are there because those spots fill very, very quickly. Right. So helping other parents, building that network of parents to support each other can be incredibly powerful.
Right. Well, we brought up a few times the Facebook groups. So I said, you know, I participate in several communities. I'm grateful for my even network of other advocates in, you know, finding that service provider, finding that placement that might be good to go to, finding that transition evaluator. You know, these are kind of obscure things that it would be very hard, I think, for a parent to find, especially with limited internet or English speaking. So I think collaboration is important. Erin also brought up there's a Facebook page. So if you're a special education teacher in Chicago, there's a support page that you should find. If you're a parent, I think it's critical to find a good network there to ask questions. I think Raise Your Hand for Illinois is awesome.
And they have a special ed parents, specifically Illinois Raise Your Hand Special Education Parents and Advocates group. Yeah. Join that group. Really knowledgeable parents who've been through the system and been through the wars can be there to support. Parents for Teachers is another amazing organization. It's a very difficult line to walk as a special ed teacher where you have to choose between advocacy and where who your employer is. You know, what I always tell teachers is get tenured, check your boxes that way. Make sure you're watching what's going on. You may need to expect retaliation. If you can find a good principal, a principal who will listen to you. I've been at the same school. My principal is very trusting of his staff. That's been a huge help for me. It's allowed me to be an advocate. Always ask for everything in writing. Because very frequently, if you teach in the Chicago public school systems, you will have people come in and speak to you with absolute authority and ask you to do illegal things. That's why I come to the special CTU Special Education Teachers Facebook group. It's run by Natasha Lee Wilson and Katie Osgood, Sarah Chambers. They're all special education teacher advocates. Katie, Natasha, and Sarah are all e-board members for CTU, very active. And we will help you get through and, you know, here's the law. Mm-hmm. Make sure you're providing that. Make sure you're covering your bases because you are going to be stuck in some tough situations to navigate.
I wish I had known about that as a teacher because I think that what happens at a lot of schools is, for one, if you're teaching in a self-contained setting, it can be a pretty isolating experience depending on how many other special ed teachers you have on your team or how well you collaborate with the rest of the school. But it's not like when I taught gen ed and I had three other classrooms teaching the same and we met weekly. It can be very isolated. And so the person you go to answer your questions is your school case manager.
Right.
Now, it was a while ago that I taught and in a lot of schools, and this structure varies among suburbs and I'm sure districts throughout the country. The school counselor and case manager used to be the same position. It was a lot of work. However, they usually, I will say, at least in my case, had some expertise about the family, you know, a lot of circumstances. But what I'm finding now is that because the case manager can't be the school counselor
anymore. Well, CTU in the last contract, no CTU employee can be forced to take on the position of case management because it was basically just a stipend. So it was like, oh, you're a special ed teacher. We're going to give you some extra money and maybe an extra prep. manage 350 IEPs. Right. It was craziness.
Well, and so what's happening is often when I am talking to student teachers and I'm saying, oh, that sounds tricky. Is the placement right? Is the IEP, like, could you amend the IEP? And they were like, you can do that. And I'm like, you need to talk to your case manager. And then I'm like, who is the case manager? And I can think of an example where it's a teacher I knew who doesn't have any experience in special ed at all.
Yeah.
And so that's problematic because I think what happens is it winds up being like a game of telephone where something is overgeneralized. Well, we can't do that because of this. And then it becomes, well, we can't do that. Well, then we can't do that ever. So know who you're going to. And I think the same is true in social media. Mm-hmm. Ask the questions, get the referrals, but know that some of your sources, like the people that Erin is citing, they really know what they're talking about.
Right.
But sometimes, again, people have this overgeneralization and a game of telephone. So know your sources, but definitely find those groups and those communities.
Yeah, build that. The network of support and having mentors is, I think, huge towards helping teachers stay in the profession. And that's another thing that scares me about because of student-based budgeting, there are schools that do not want experienced teachers in them in Chicago because they can hire a body for $20,000 or $30,000 less and have a brand new teacher covering a position that would have cost them more if they had an experienced teacher who had been teaching for 10 years. And so you will find schools in the city of Chicago, particularly on our south and our west sides, that have no teachers that have more than 5 years experience. Mm-hmm. The principal may not have taught for more than 5 years. They literally did the bare minimum amount of time to become eligible to take the Type 75. They become the Type 75. It's a whole problem. And then it's very difficult in that situation to be advocating because you don't have people backing you up. You don't have, it's a lot to negotiate. You're also probably dealing with the most traumatized students in the city. You are dealing with some of the most like just horrific violence and things that children have gone through. And everybody on your staff knows just as much as you do. And nobody knows what they're doing.
You are setting yourself up for like a chain of like reactive responses to things that have gone very badly because no one was equipped or prepared to, you know, set things up in a way that benefits everybody in the first place, which is just terribly unfortunate. So, you know, in addition to the trauma checklist that was brought up before, something that Erin has is tools for self-care for teachers. Mm-hmm. Do you want to kind of touch on some of the ideas in here? Because I think this is really important.
Yeah.
We talked about boundaries, and I'll say assertiveness training is something I think we should require as part of teacher training as well to prevent that burnout. But what is some other self-care advice?
Yes. No. And then, so also one, recognizing that you have this issue, that it's affecting you, I think is hugely important because you can't address a problem if you're not recognizing what's causing it. And hopefully, like, I'm actually going to try to see this, the packet I referenced earlier from, the Safe Supportive Learning Environments Council was they have a plan for the school and they have a plan for the individual teacher, which I think is hugely important. That's something we need to advocate and push for as educators, as parents, and that we are building sustainable schools in that teachers can stay and work there. And so like it goes through here and it asks you to like rate, like, are you eating regularly? Are you eating healthy? Do you have time to, exercise and rating and looking at that, at how often do you get enough sleep? When you are in the midst of a really bad burnout situation and you can't even get your laundry done because you are so overwhelmed by work, it seems silly, wear clothes that you like, but those are the things that will get away from you when you are just barely keeping your head above water. And so it goes through and it talks about psychological self-care, spiritual self-care, emotional self-care. And I think that taking time to go through and looking at that and thinking about it is really important for setting yourself up for success. The other thing I would tell teachers, because teachers have that perfectionist mentality, is if you got hit by a bus tomorrow, there would be another adult in front of your class. You know, put the oxygen mask on yourself first. Mm-hmm. You can't pour from an empty cup. If you are not taking care of yourself, you're not, you're like, there's going to be nothing that you can give for, to your kids. There's nothing, you're not gonna be able to do better. So you need to like to actually just sit there and it seems silly, but like go through and like think about, am I taking care of myself? And you can't just always wait for the summer.
No, right. I know, it's always there and it goes by quickly. I think when we were talking before about like that stoic accepting what you can change and what you can't, I think the problem is that there are a lot of expectations with the job,
yes.
right? And they have to be done because there are consequences, you know, especially working in advocacy work. It's like, well, where's the data? Well,
right.
Where is this? Well, where is that? So I think it's really important too for teachers to have a system in place that sort of runs itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of like when you're frequently changing things and you're not getting it right. I think this is a trap I fell into as a teacher. Plus, I love novelty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I didn't see something working really well, I was changing it. I was changing it. I was changing it. And I think I would caution, especially early teachers, like do that collaboration, have a mentor, find your resources. But like try to cut down on the number of decisions that you need to make because it's exhausting.
Yeah,
it's really exhausting. And then if you can't make something work, I guess this is my question to you. If you can't control something and it's a problem, there's no time to implement it. Mm-hmm. What's your advice to teachers if you can't meet the basic expectations of the job? What do you do?
Well, I think you have to sort of prioritize. That's one of the things. There could be a million things thrown at your head. Okay. And Karen Lewis was always famous for it. She would say, I'll get to that. Close your door and teach your babies. So you have to stop and think, what are my legally mandated responsibilities? My whole philosophy is this is what I did and this is why I did it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, my first responsibility is to that IEP. And then it's to making sure the grades are in. And then, you know, well, into the kids first. But like when you talk about paperwork aspects of the job, it's IEP first.
Right.
Okay. That is the legally mandated document that has to be met. That has to be done. You don't have a choice about that. If a principal is trying to get you to do something that is not the IEP, and this is something in the task force and the committee we're fighting for to get them to like, you know, remove some of the requirements in special ed teachers, that the IEP is the central document that has to be managed and met first.
And Erin, what if that IEP sucks?
Then you revise that IEP.
Thank you. We talked briefly before.
Yes.
I won't go into it. But yeah, sometimes you inherit an IEP.
Yes.
Or it was written by somebody who didn't have maybe the same training.
Right.
And background. And so if it's not a good fit, and often they need to be revised even if somebody did a good job writing
right.
it with what they knew at the time.
Yeah.
You need to revise that IEP.
And especially for the setting, I run into this all the time with my kids transitioning from pre-K programs into our kindergarten full day. And it's the needs are just very different in a half day pre-K program where they might have taken a nap and they might have done all this stuff. Then you come into the full day and this kid is like spitting out and they are not getting what they need because that transition is so difficult.
Well, and little kids, I mean, I always say when you're writing an IEP, you're projecting, you're guessing,
mm-hmm.
you're making the best guess you can about where that kid's going to be a year from now.
Right.
And for little kids, especially, it's even harder to project because the growth could be so rapid and so different. Okay. So revise the IEP, not to make your life easier. Well, it may indirectly make your life easier, but to meet the needs of your learner and to do it in a way that you can do your job
right.
and collect the data you need to and build trust with the parents, talk to them about what's being revised. It's a good opportunity, I think.
And good data is better than more data. Get effective data. Don't take data on everything because and pick and choose when you're taking that data.
Yes.
You know, because you don't need to be, if you are putting in that you're going to daily track all of these goals, I mean, maybe if you're a resource team, I mean, I'm coming from a special ed self-contained sort of perspective. There is one, the amount of having taken daily, unless I'm dealing with a severe behavior issue or I'm dealing with something like that, having taking time to taking data on everything that this child does is not effective. Taking data twice a week, you know, once every other week, and as long as I'm continuing to track and we're and it doesn't mean you don't continue to work on those skills, but the actual point that I stop and I take the data that I then, mm-hmm. you know, document on, it doesn't matter. You know, like that's where I think people get in. Don't write 18 million goals. That mm-hmm. you know, do what is going to be practical and feasible to be done. Write what is needed. I'm not arguing don't write what's needed. If the kid needs a social emotional goal, if the kid needs an independent functioning goal, you write those goals. You write the academic goals. But, you know, if you've got six language arts goals and three, you're never going to do it. And then what you will be done poorly. So I would much rather you go and do something that is functional and feasible, and start working on setting up those systems too.
Right. And that's what I think of is we caution, you don't want to use like a goal bank. You don't want to copy and paste goals. And I can tell you many times I've seen an IEP where you're talking about a female student and then the goal, it'll say he will. And it's like, clearly the teacher copied and pasted and people are horrified. And I'm like, well, yes, but if it fits, if it's the same grade level, it's the same common, if it's the same standard, you know, and they need to work on written expression and they need to work on conventions, it's not the worst thing. I can see where a teacher's mind goes, because in your classroom, you want to have systems that kind of run themselves. And then in your head, when you're writing a goal, you'll know that you're able to monitor that writing goal, because every 2 weeks they're going to do a work sample and you plan on collecting it anyway. So I think having that structure, like a really clear structure in mind and not changing constantly and too many things at once.
Yeah.
That will be helpful. And it helps the paraprofessionals, I think, or anybody and your students as well. So not a lot of decisions. Advocating for yourself to your principal in writing is the advice. And I say the same, you know, to parents, like if you've requested something from the school, it has to be in writing. So, you know, put it in writing.
Well, and the other trick that I would do, is especially when I'm dealing sometimes with district administrators, people outside of my school level, they'll come in and they'll have a conversation and they'll tell you something crazy. And you say, you email them back.
Yes.
Per our conversation on X date at this time, I just want to clarify that my understanding is bop, 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 bop. If you agree that this is correct, you know, great, we've got it. If there's an issue, please email me back. And then suddenly things will change. Because they do know. The other thing I would caution you too, like I have a district rep that I've worked with that I have a lot of respect for, but they also have a boss. And their boss and people who are making decisions that are forcing them to make decisions. So sometimes you're dealing with a chain. It's not malicious. It's not vindictive. I get on some of them. I'll leave it alone. But mostly people are just trying to do the best. And they have been given a set of directives that they must follow.
Right.
And so it's the same thing with parents. Often teachers are dealing with a set of directives coming from someone outside of them that they need to follow. And that's where parent advocacy is really key, because sometimes you can come in and force an issue that the teacher would not have been in a position to force, because they're direct. They would have to be going in direct opposition of their supervisor.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean the other trick that I use it very selectively. I had a student who was in a particularly unique situation, and I basically came in to an IEP meeting and I said, I think I made everybody feel guilty. I was like, nobody has advocated for this kid. This has been going on for too long. They need this dedicated aide. They need this aide who's trained in this. I am not signing this IEP. I am attaching dissenting opinion if this is not added to the IEP. Okay. That was an extreme case. I'm not telling you as a first year teacher, don't do that. Don't go do that. But you are going to eventually in your career get to that place, and you are going to like pick the hill you want to die on. That was the hill I was willing to die on. That was the hill I was willing to go to war on, because this was such an extreme situation. But I could also, this is what I did and this is why I did it, and I could justify it and I could live with myself, because I, you know, so as teachers, pick your battles, pick what you want to fight over. But also, like, if you know that there is something that is directly harmful to a child, like, and that I often see this where we're writing IEPs that are inappropriate, we're forcing kids into either into self-contained situations that are not appropriate for them, or we're forcing them into general education that's not appropriate for them either. You know, teachers are stuck, and you need to at some point say, this is not right for this kid. And there are going to be long-term consequences for that, not for that child, but also the room. If you are putting a very emotionally disturbed child or a kid with autism who has extreme sensory issues, and you're going to force them into a room with 38 kids, that you're going to blow up that classroom. You're going to blow up that kid's life. Your life is going to get a lot harder. And that's what you have to communicate to the administrator. this is going to cause problems. This is not going to work. This is why this is not going to work. We need to look at other options. And people will be afraid to advocate for it. But you can take the data, have your data, and then you can push for a change in placement.
There it is. That's what I was going to interrupt on, is we said before, more data is not better. However, not having enough data,
right,
that can really be a problem. So as you know, as a teacher, it's hard. I think what Erin brings up of like Ashley dissenting in an IEP meeting, not a lot of teachers feel safe to do that. You know, we have kind of a good situation for you relatively in that the administration is solid, probably knows as well. So all those pieces have to fall into place, and don't get down on yourself too much if they don't, because you're doing the best you can for your kids. Main takeaways for special ed teachers to avoid burnout.
First is you will experience post-secondary trauma. It's going to happen to you. I don't really care where you teach. If you teach in the most wealthy district or you teach in the most challenged, economically depressed area in the country, you will experience secondary trauma at some point in your teaching career. You will have a child that is going through things, or is the foster care child, or all of these things. So you need to prepare yourself for that. Mm-hmm. You need to recognize when you start showing signs of it, and then you need to start taking care of yourself, because if you're not taking care of yourself, you cannot take care of those kids.
And I would say prepare for that. So mm-hmm. the way that we prepare, and I think about anxiety, is you can be resilient and you can overcome if your supports are in place to get you over that hump. So maintain those networks with other teachers. Have that personal network of mm-hmm. support. Have a plan to escape and to take time off and to draw those boundaries. That's also, I think, a really, really important part of that self-care. Number two,
learn to prioritize. I think it's a big part. It ties into that. You are not going to be able to do everything. You are not going to be all things to all people. Find out what is your legal responsibility and what is going to make things better. It's dangerous. I don't want to go there. But like, being organized is a huge thing with teaching. Taking the time to be organized about stuff and to pre-plan and prepare is going to remove so much stress from your life if you've got it. When you make something, save it in an organized manner. I look back when I started teaching, and you're on this rat race and you're trying. But I think about, like, you know, and Google Drive wasn't a thing when I started teaching. But now I have hundreds of folders of, and if I need an activity on this, I know I can go in and I can open that folder and I've got it and it's there. Mm-hmm. And so really taking that time to get organized, that is always going to be time well spent, because it is going to make all things easier as you go forward. So really, like, just prioritize IEP, right? Mm-hmm. Legal responsibilities, number one. Number two, grading and those things that you have to do for your performance, evaluate the structure, the stuff, those are things you're going to do. But you're going to run stuff where they're going to ask you for, like, some schools are asking for crazy lesson plans, and they're asking for this, and they're asking for that. Part of me wonders, like, who is actually reviewing any of this documentation that we created? That's something I run into Chicago, where I fill out all of these forms, I do all this stuff, and I think it sits in a folder and nobody ever looked at it, but I had to take the time to write it. So if you can, you know, save things to copy and paste of, you know, templates, organization, this stuff that you can just go in and make it simpler. But know that if you got hit by a bus, there would be someone else in front of your kids. So don't kill yourself to have the special unit plan, Don't go and make it 18 pages when it needs to be 3.
So Erin, you're saying don't go on Pinterest and find beautiful bulletin board ideas all through the school year. I see these are mm-hmm. kind of extra things.
Right.
They look beautiful, but really that organization, that structure, like I said, cut down on decisions in advance as much as you need to. And I would say show your lesson plan template that works for you. Maybe you do a weekly overview. Maybe mm-hmm. you do a group, you know, whatever it is that, because all of our brains organize information in such different ways. You know, if they're requiring something from you, I would say go to your administrator and say, this is what I use. What do you need more on this mm-hmm. sheet to make it your criteria?
Right. No. And then take the time to make a template of it that has the standards, that has your access standards, on all of that in there. And just, you know, you have it. And then maybe you go and you just have to adjust the standard. Like, your morning routine should be pretty similar. Like, it's not going to be, don't reinvent the wheel. I would say teacher pay teachers, because sometimes we often want to, like, make stuff where if you could spend $2 and you're going to get this pre-made thing that you just got to download and, like, you could print. Totally worth your time.
Teachers pay teachers can be a little like Target for me.
Yeah.
Where you go in looking for word families and you walk out $100 later. However, I think that the key idea that prioritizes is so important. And like we talked about, knowing what the important parts are on each kid's IEP, knowing what that structure looks like, putting it in place, that should help save your sanity and also help you with that piece we talked about before, which is also prioritization of what do I have to accept and what's in my control.
Right.
Like, let's just figure that out and come to terms with it as early on as possible. And if it's something that you can't control that needs to be changed, it's going to take extra energy to have to address that. And you also have to buffer your schedule with not designing that bulletin board because, you know, IEPs come up, behavior plans come up.
Yes.
You kind of have to pad.
Well, the other thing too, I would say with scheduling is some of the best of advice I got was, especially at primary, do not be afraid to slow down and teach routine. Like, if I don't really, I monitor IEP stuff, but I don't really jump into it in September because it is much more functional for my kids. For myself, if we learn how to use the visual schedule, we learn how to do center rotations, we learn how to be in class, and we just slow down and take the time. And don't be afraid to do one thing at a time and then add. As soon as the kids get comfortable and gain mastery, add one more. I think often we try to jump in. I think teachers get frustrated with schedules and get frustrated with centers because they threw the kids in and the kids don't understand how to do centers and how to do center rotation. And it's like,
yes.
And it's like, but that I think was some of the best advice I ever got was slow down, teach the fundamental skill first, teach how to do it. And then you can build from there. And then it's going to be less stressful on the kids and it's going to be less stressful on you. So that doesn't mean we play like the rest of the year, but make a conscious choice. I am going to teach this skill. This skill is important.
Yep.
We're going to focus on it. And then we're going to build from it. And we're going to increase academic rigor. And we're going to go from there.
I could totally go off on a tangent, too, about how teachers will say, well, they should know what to do. Well, they should know how to do this. Again, I'll bring it back to, you know, like a middle school, say. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, they should be doing this on their own. And it's like, no, they need to be taught how to do it. And you have to check for mastery before you remove that support.
Right.
So that would avoid a lot of frustration. And third, I mean, I'm really thinking about training, PD.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that I think of one program I participated in Chicago was the Boundless Readers, Rochelle Lee, which it was a grant funded program in reading, but it was a professional learning group. And so I think that really seek out, I'm filling in the blanks for you, but what training or how can you, because I think that one theme that emerges is feeling more expert, feeling more capable really helps in a lot of these areas.
I think especially this is primarily more for teachers who are coming into the city to work. And I do, I see a lot, and I'm white, so I see a lot of white teachers come into the city. It is something that happens, but I don't know that we really take the time to become informed on cultural needs, on the historical systems that exist around racism. I think educate yourself on ACE scores, on trauma, on how those things affect kids and their development, on how these things affect communities. You're not going to get that sort of PD necessarily. Like there is a push for culturally relevant, but you need to actually go out there and as someone who is white, I have a responsibility to educate myself. If you are a white teacher who is coming to work in a black neighborhood, you need to educate yourself on the history of that neighborhood, on the history of that community. You need to be open. You need to be available to parents. I think that sometimes people are uncomfortable. And so that comes off to parents as you being judgmental or cold or unaccepting, especially special ed teachers, I would tell you is hugely important that you provide positive feedback to the parents. Often their child, if you are a parent of a Black male child in this country right now, it's a very scary time. It's always been scary, but it's a scary world. Your child has been that problem child. You have probably had negative. That was a huge thing when I worked with EDBD kids, that the parents felt like you were judging them, that they were bad parents, that their kids had these issues, that you were judging them, that they had, that their kid was not seeing the things that were great about their kid. So taking that time to just be open and be caring and establish those relationships with parents, is going to pay off for you in, huge ways. A strong parent relationship, even with difficult parents, even with parents that are challenging, it is much better that you are open and communicating with them. You don't always have to agree with them. I think in the entire time I've been teaching, I have actually only ran into two parents where we couldn't get anywhere with each other. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of issues and stuff going on with those particular situations. But the vast majority of my parents, all of them want what's best for their children.
So I feel like two points. Mm-hmm. One, whatever training it is you need, and I think you're right, culturally responsive learning is really, really important. We talked about Ross Green, dealing with behavior. When you're feeling a disconnect, when you're feeling like burnt out in an area, it's probably a sign that you do need to seek out more information on it,
yeah.
Right? To find those labels, to find, I'm using labels in a positive way, to be able to label that concept, right? And learn more about it. I just want to stress too to parents that it doesn't feel like a safe space for a lot of teachers to be revealing some of the shortcomings of the system within their classroom as well. So can we just, let's have a little patience with each other and still try to do the best we can.
Yeah. And often, like, if you're in Chicago and if you are having trouble and you need parents who need supports, then you can come to the Facebook group and I will help them get hooked up with people, other parents, outside parents for teachers or other advocates who can. Because sometimes you can guide a parent to, and that's not a conversation you are in a place to have, but you can, I, as an outside person, could guide a parent to a parent advocate to have, you know, help them gain the information that they need or gain the resources that they need. So building that network, being aware of advocacy, being aware of those things, I think does in the long term help teachers, even if you're not in a position because you have to. You have a job and you like, and retaliation is real. I don't want anybody not to take that seriously. And sometimes even when you advocate for things that are about the physical well-being and safety of your students, you can still be retaliated against for. So like you need to be aware of that and you need to learn how to negotiate that. But just like when I watched that IEP meeting and had my little tantrum and was like, I'm attaching a dissenting opinion. I don't care. There are points where you have to go, okay, I can't in good conscience, like, continue this.
It's integrity.
Yes. Cause there are points and, you know, and sometimes like literally we're working with kids' lives when the entire ISB issues happened because Claypool had made all those cuts. That's sort of when I got involved in advocacy, because some of my fellow cluster teachers were talking about the cuts in the SACAs and were like, oh my God, someone's going to die. And that young man drowned at Kelly High School because he didn't have a one-on-one aid. So sometimes like it is okay. Like you have to know where your line and your point is. And I'm encouraging you to be educated and an advocate, but to do it smartly and to build a network and get help.
These darn decisions.
I know.
You know, hard. I mean, I just feel like, you know, on one hand, we're saying, you know, let those battles, you have to pick those battles.
Right.
But the reality is you can see the burden of responsibility that you feel when you know that you're in charge. You have such a huge impact on, and literally what Erin just brought up is it can be life and death.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a life and death type of situation. So know that there are groups out there who will support you as a teacher. There are places to turn. And as a parent, you know, I think too, and I've shared before, like going in as an advocate and, you know, working in the teacher prep, I think it's almost like that a rising tide lifts all ships. So, yeah. You know, if one parent can bring someone in to fight some injustice, sometimes that can be helpful for everybody. So good to know. Hopefully I will follow up on this one with a list of resources that will be on the blog for everybody. Erin, that was awesome. Thank you so much for coming in. I hope that people find it helpful. And if you have questions specifically, remember that you can always record them or email them to me as well. And I will follow up on the Facebook page there or possibly even do another episode. I would love to have Erin back to answer some questions. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.